Hello and welcome back. My name is Luke and you're listening to another episode of the Next Stage podcast by Web Summit, taking you inside the minds of business and cultural leaders from around the world. It's Wednesday, and every Wednesday we're looking at some of the best and brightest minds that Web Summit has to offer. So sit back, relax, and listen in as we hear from the leading minds and industry giants from all over the planet.
Protests that swept the country in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last spring have brought the racism of the criminal justice system into stark relief for all Americans. Despite some differences of opinion over matters like the activist call to defund the police, a consensus seems to be emerging that major reform is urgent and necessary, and in fact is a moral imperative for our democracy. But how can it be achieved? What prospects are there under the administration of Joe Biden for systemic change? I'm Betsy Reed, editor-in-chief of The Intercept, and we're joined today for this discussion by the president of the Reform Alliance, Bob Pylon, and the Reform Alliance's CEO, Van Jones. I'd like to start with you, Van, telling us a little bit about the Reform Alliance. Just at the broadest level, what approach do you take to addressing the crisis of mass incarceration, and how is it different from, you know, the various other protest movements that have emerged around this issue?
Well, very happy to be here and talk about the Reform Alliance. We are a two-year-old organization. We were actually started by Jay-Z and Meek Mill and a bunch of high-powered billionaires who are just really tired of just how unfairly our criminal justice system treats people, especially people who are, low economic means or who are African-American, Latino, Latina, Native American, all the stuff that everybody knows about. We have a unique approach, which is we know there are 2 million people who are locked up in our prison system, which is a horrific injustice. You know, China, which has 1 billion people, only has 1 million people technically locked up. But we not only have 2 million who are locked up, we also have an additional 4 million plus who are caught up on probation and parole, which most people never think about. There's basically a massive revolving door back into the system. Two-thirds of the people who are under control of our justice system are actually on probation and parole, and they are literally just one traffic ticket away from going back to prison. And so we work on that issue, and we've been blessed to pass a couple of major bills this year, got a federal bill coming up next year. But it's such a massive system. You can literally have 4 million people who are not free to even go see a relative without permission. That's a part of the problem as well.
Thanks. In terms of your past efforts, what would you say that is your biggest achievement so far? Bob, you want to address that?
Sure. First, let me thank you, Betsy, and the Web Summit for having us. When the organization was launched 2 years ago and Meek Mill's story was kind of really illuminated as, there are, as Van said, 4 million people in the system that are on probation or parole. And so the opportunity for us to be able to educate the American public on technicalities and how people go back to prison for doing everyday things. We worked with someone last year named Maurice Hudson, who is a 29-year-old father of two, janitor in Philadelphia, had a $1,900 fine outstanding and was sentenced to 2 years back in prison because of a $1,900 fine outstanding. In this country, we are putting people in prison for being poor in some cases. Thankfully, to Van and Michael Rubin and Meek Mill, Maurice's case got the light of day, and a judge overturned that sentence and his fines were paid off. That type of awareness of 4 million people in this revolving door is one of the things that we're really proud of over the last 18 months, is being able to illuminate stories like that, get the attention they deserve, and being able to then translate those wins into policy change. And that's what we've been working on, on the state level, and like Van said, in the federal level, starting next year. But we're just started, and the education piece, and making sure the American public know that there are 4 million people on probation and parole. Many of those people, most of those people are good people. They just had a bad day or made a bad decision that shouldn't dictate years or decades of their life. And so I'd say that the first phase of Reform Alliance history is really getting the American people to understand, you know, how stupid a lot of the technical, you know, kind of makeup of our system is, and translating that now into policy change across the country.
And I just also add, in addition to some of the storytelling, we also have been able to pass real powerful laws. In California, have the most transformative probation a bill in the country. We were able to get that passed. We got a bill through in Louisiana. We're knocking on the door in Michigan and Pennsylvania. So we're, you know, we're telling the stories. We're also changing the laws. We also been able to get tens of thousands of people released from prison ahead of this COVID crisis. Not enough. Too many are left behind and in harm's way. But we got support from Jack Dorsey, which is something that Bob worked on very hard to get PPE into jails and prisons and to get people out of jails and prisons. So we've been very busy these past couple of years, changing conversation, changing laws, and saving lives.
In the present political environment, it really couldn't be more polarized, right? I mean, we have one party that is refusing even, or large parts of it, refusing even to acknowledge the victory of the other party in the presidential election. So how do you pursue a robust agenda of reform, especially if the Senate remains in the hands of Mitch McConnell?
Well, Mitch McConnell was the head of the Senate when the First Step Act was passed, which I played a role in before reform got started. No such thing as a perfect bill. And from our point of view, no such thing as a bill that is comprehensive enough. That said, the New York Times called the First Step Act the most substantial breakthrough in criminal justice in a generation. Mitch McConnell was head of the Senate at that point. This issue can get done because both sides can see how it offends their own values. If you're a liberal or progressive like I am, you look at the criminal justice system and what you see is a massive lack of dignity and massive injustice in our justice system. We look at people of color being hurt. As Bob just said, people who just don't have money being hurt. And yet our conservative sisters and brothers can also see things that offend their values. Conservatives really believe in the idea of liberty, limited government, individual rights and responsibility. Well, there's no more anti-liberty system than what we have right now, where you have a massive failed government bureaucracy that's gobbling up liberties and rights and dollars and giving you terrible outcomes. And we've been able to find ways for conservatives from Newt Gingrich to, you know, literally Donald Trump, even the Koch brothers have at times weighed in and said, too much is too much and something can get done. Unbelievably, ironically, in the 90s, the common ground issue between the two parties was building and filling more prisons. Everybody wanted to be tough on crime. Here we are in the 2020s, and the common ground for both parties is we went too far. We need to start pulling back on this and doing a better job.
Although, I mean, it does seem that both the mainstream of the Democratic Party and the Republicans are really pushing back against the movement against police brutality and, you know, the various, you know, the calls to defund the police, but also the kind of more radical agenda of activists coming from the grassroots. So, but your approach with Reform Alliance is more to focus on the parole and probation system rather than on, you know, the various issues that that we could address in terms of an out of control and unaccountable police force.
Well, look, the Reform's mission is focused on probation and parole and ultimately with, you know, reentry overall. But you know, look, I've been a part of this movement for a long time. I started out suing cops and police departments in my early mid 20s. I got a Yale Law School when I was 24 years old, and the first thing I did was start suing law enforcement. I'm from a law enforcement family, and I don't think it should be a radical idea that the police should obey the law. And when you see so much evidence of police lawlessness, what you wind up with is communities crushed between street violence and unlawful police violence, and nobody's needs getting met. I don't see pushback against accountability for police and some police reform. I do see some pushback around how it's described and how you talk about it, a lot of rhetorical argument. You know, should you say defund the police, demilitarize the police, rebalance city agents? But so there's sometimes there's argument about language. But I do think that the polls show that the majority of Americans think that it needs to be some reform of our police departments and much more accountability for police officers who do the wrong thing. And you know, that's a new consensus in America, and the argument about what you call it doesn't take anything away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. A lot of the heat is around that slogan, but there's also the question of qualified immunity and, you know, where that the push for that legislation goes from here. Where do you see that the path for that that reform, which is crucial to holding police accountable for their actions?
I think there are three things that you need if you want to have a better and more accountable policing. Right now, it's very hard to discipline, demote, or fire a police officer. So even our best police chiefs can't discipline, demote, or fire our worst cops because the police unions have bubble wrapped police in so much protective layer and process that you can't even get the worst ones out. That has to change. Also, you can't sue them individually. The Supreme Court says they have qualified immunity. So that means when you sue a police officer, there's basically a taxpayer-funded bailout for bad cops, because when you sue the police officer, you actually are just suing yourself. You're suing the city, and the taxpayer has to pay for what the cop did. So ending these kind of taxpayer-funded bailouts for bad cops, called ending qualified immunity, is one leg. But the other leg is that when someone breaks the law and hurts someone, they should go to jail or at least stand trial. And right now, most prosecutors are afraid to do that. So it's really a three-legged stool. People need to be, if you want accountability, people have to be able to be disciplined, demoted, or fired, sued, and prosecuted. None of that's happening, which is why, not at the scale that's appropriate, which is why you have so much so many problems and so much unaddressed misconduct. Qualified immunity is important. It's not a magic bullet. It won't fix everything. There's a lot of reform that needs to get done. Some of it will be done at the state and local level. Less will get done at the federal level than would have been done if you had, you know, a united, I think, democratic control of the federal government. But there are things that can be done through executive order. Trump may put forward a modest, I think, welcome and but still too modest executive order. Biden can do much more through executive order, and we'll see where this movement goes. But I don't think that the argument about language will stop the movement from being successful where it is reasonable and making common sense demands.
I want to pivot for a minute to the state level, because while a lot of the discourse around mass incarceration and policing occurs at the national level, a lot of the most meaningful kind of policy changes happen at the state and local level. And one thing that we've, a bright spot of the last few years has been the successful campaigns of progressive DAs around the country. Bob, do you have some comment, particularly on what's going on in California around, you know, the election of progressive DAs? And do you have, are you hopeful that that could help, you know, pave the way for some real change?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, first, you know, we've seen it in Los Angeles over the last several weeks. I think to Van's last point, the activist community has really come out in full force, and not only just by marching in the streets, but by voting. And I feel like, you know, the more we can educate the public about candidates, and, you know, and we're a C3, so we're not endorsing, I feel really confident that people are digging in more, right? They're not just looking at TV advertisements, not just looking at who has got the best marketing and the best name, but they're really digging in to see who the right criminal justice reform advocates are going to be if getting elected. And so particularly in California, and what we've seen over the last, you know, several weeks in Los Angeles with the election of Gascon, the public is really really becoming more educated on these issues. And I hope, you know, I'm still relatively young, I hope that the momentum of what happened in the last several weeks with 160 million people around the country voting continues, because I firmly believe that we're going to get the right people in office with that level of enthusiasm and excitement, you know, for to elect people.
So we only have a couple minutes left. One more question. In terms of Reform Alliance's agenda, you know, next major goal, where do you see the organization putting its emphasis in the next, you know, say, year?
I'll let Bob close this out. Go ahead, Bob.
Sure. Well, as Van mentioned earlier, you know, we've been working in a few states over the last 18 months, got a couple of big wins, particularly here in California and AB 1950. Now we're going to shift the organization's energy, you know, to a federal bill. You know, we believe there's 80% of the people are under state jurisdiction that are in the system. So the federal bill enables us to create fertility and to have something we can then in 2022 kind of copycat, if you will, across the country. So building the marketing, the communications capacity in getting the narrative shifted, that, you know, the one thing I've realized in criminal justice is historically they focus a lot of attention on the people in the system, which is the right thing to do, a lot less attention on the families affected and communities affected. So we really want to start telling the story of kids whose father or mother are in the system, and how that impacts them. And we feel like we'll move the needle. And ultimately, you know, moving the needle is great, but if it doesn't come with policy change, it doesn't mean anything. And so that 1-2 punch of really smart marketing communications with a rock star advocacy team led by Jessica Jackson in Washington is going to be the heart of the work over the next 12 to 18 months.
And also just to clarify, we are going to be adding that federal bill. We will still be in those states, though. We'll still be in the Pennsylvanias and the Michigans or whatever. So we're going to be now in our third year expanding that capacity to add in that that federal punch as well. Very excited about all those aspects.
Well, thank you both. This has been very illuminating, and I wish you the best of luck with your agenda.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more about these topics firsthand, or you want to let us know what you want to hear, be sure to check us out on any of our social media accounts or visit websummit.com. That's websummit.com.